Welcome back. I'm Julie Glenn. This is Gulf Coast Live. There are only 89 restaurants in the world whose wine list merits a grand award from the Wine Spectator magazine. In the state of Florida, there are only two that made that cut, Blue Provence in Naples and Burns Steakhouse in Tampa. Burns has been a destination for wine aficionados for decades and has been regularly receiving the grand award for just as long, due mainly to the passion and buying habits of the restaurant's founder, Mr. Bern Laxer. Well known for its older vintage wines, Burns' wine list boasts hundreds of selections by the glass, thousands by the bottle, and a large percentage of those are very mature vintages. Burns Steakhouse is now run by Burns' son, David Laxer, and Eric Renault is the sommelier who helps oversee the wine program. Eric, welcome to Gulf Coast Live. How long have you been working in the Burns cellar?
I've been at Burns for just a little over 21 years.
Wow, that's been a while.
Yeah, it seems like a lifetime.
So how was the wine situation when you first started?
In many aspects, it was even more exciting than it is today. When I started there, wine was becoming popular. It was becoming the norm. More and more people were getting into wine, but Burn had this amazing collection that over the last 20 years, as the secret's gotten out and more and more people are into wine, some of the really amazing parts of the collection have dwindled down. For example, we do not have any pre-1900 table wines anymore. When I started here, we probably had 100 different pre-1900 table wines.
You mean wines from the vintages of 1800s?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, we're actually in the process of trying to procure some from a couple different chateaus who might still have some in Bordeaux. It's tough because we will not buy, at auction in today's climate of the auctions.
Yeah, they're a little risky with the counterfeits and the way people store things.
Exactly. And we won't take that risk because we take full responsibility for the wine. So the wine's bad, you don't pay for it. So, we don't want to take that risk of buying an auction and then, having to eat it.
Tell me a little bit about Burns' wine list for someone who doesn't really know much about wine. What makes it so different?
It was Burns' mentality, I believe, his mentality, and now his son has taken over, is wine is for everybody. So there is wines at all price point, wines of all type on our wine list. I mean, we have wines that are $19 for a bottle up to $30,000 for a bottle. We offer a little over 6,500 different table wines. There's about 1,000 or so dessert wines, like 50 eau de vies, and a couple hundred different scotches, Armagnacs, bourbons. If you enjoy any kind of alcoholic drink, you can pretty much find it at Burns, and oftentimes it's the only place you can find it.
What is most interesting to someone walking into Burns for the first time is the fact that you have this extensive wine list, and it's not just that it's extensive, but it has old vintages, and they're also not priced accordingly. They're not as expensive as you would expect. I mean, you can get something accessible that is pre-1970.
I like the way you put that. They're not priced accordingly, but Burn bought, and when he bought, if he liked something, he was not shy about buying. So whether it was in Europe, whether it was in California, if he liked it, and then whether it was Andre Chelichev or Harry Waugh that he was traveling with, if they all agreed that the wine was really good, Burn would spend almost every penny and sometimes more money than he had buying large quantities. I'm talking hundreds of cases of a wine back then. He had a couple guys in Florida that they would bring an entire container over just for these three guys, and then he would bring it into Burns and store it. So even buying in quantity back then, obviously the price would go down. So he was pennies on the dollar of some of these wines. He, again, listened to the right people, put the correct storage conditions in, and he just really made some great choices. So that being said, he made the wines affordable. If he got a good deal, he passed that deal on to his customer. Even to to this day, you know, we get good deals, we pass that on. If you look at our glass list, which is about 150 wines on our glass list, you can find, you know, wines at a fraction of the cost of what they'd be elsewhere. We get a good deal, we pass that on.
Do you find that it's possible to continue to do that kind of buying in today's day and age? Has the wine market changed to the point that it's impossible to buy the way that he used to buy?
It is impossible. Sometimes it gives me almost fit with some of these distributors and such, and it's not their fault. Again, the wine world has exploded. So where, you know, I know when I first started, there was a spot in the warehouse, and then just it's amazing. There was 5 12 packs, full cases of 1979 Etienne Gigal Lalandon. Today, we are offered maybe 3 bottles a year, where back then, Byrne could purchase as much as he wanted. And today, that price is multiple times more expensive on top of it. So we could never buy 5 cases, nor would we, because the price wouldn't make sense for us.
It wouldn't bear out. But back then, people didn't know who Gigal was. Nobody was interested in Rhone.
Right.
But just the fact that people have discovered it, now it just has become harder to get.
And it's across the board, whether it's Burgundy, you know, Bordeaux. It's sad, but it's great. I mean, the fact that more and more Americans are drinking wine, it's great for everybody, I think, my opinion. But same time, it's sad that, you know, there are wines now that are collector wines. They're not really wines for drinking. You can't just enjoy them. People buy them to store them away and add to their collection.
And they become more of a commodity.
Exactly.
But does that make you look for wines from other lesser-known regions? For example, something like a Teraldego from Trentino Alto Adige, just other places that people still have yet to discover? Do you think there are gems there that can be found?
Well, you know, there are gems everywhere. I was in Bordeaux, actually, beginning of June, and it was amazing. I mean, there's over 10,000 chateaus in Bordeaux, but everybody just thinks of all your classified growths. So there are deals. There are bargains, I think, everywhere, but it's finding them. It's finding a distributor. You know, Florida is a pretty tough state, being the three-tiered state. So trying to get them here is sometimes an issue. And that could be from, you know, California, they're small producers, but they're too small to have a distributor. So there are wines like that out there, but finding them is more difficult, for sure.
And the logistics have become more difficult because the economy of it has become tougher. I mean, when you have a small producer from California, if he can sell direct to consumer, he's going to make more money on it, especially if he has a limited amount of bottles.
Exactly. 100% correct. It's, you know, again, I'm happy for the consumer. For us, it's tough. And especially, you know, we're known, you know, people come in, we want to have something we haven't had before. A lot of times that means old wine. But if they want something young, it's hard for me to say, well, no one else has this in Florida because I still have to use a distributor. So it makes the keeping, you know, I guess the mystique, if you would, of Burns makes it a little tougher these days to do that. Now, there are wineries that will bring in just a case into the state with a distributor for us. So we do have some of that going. Again, thanks to Byrne and his son and those who come before me. But it is definitely much tougher, I think, today than it was, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago.
So when Byrne was originally amassing this collection, was the distribution system different?
You know, I would think it had to have been. Well, I know for a fact. And I love, for example, it was the 74 Inglenotes across the board, whether it's Cab, Merlot, Chardonnay, Charbonneau, Pinot Noir that Byrne bought, and he bought hundreds of cases. On the north side of Burns is train tracks. Well, story goes, now I wasn't here back then, the story is that train stopped there and they unloaded the entire train car of the Inglenooks right into our warehouse. Never would that be able to happen today.
Yeah, that would not fly.
No, so it was a different thing. I mean, you know, it's like you say, the commodity of it, the business of wine wasn't what it is today. Again, he was able to amass it because of that reason. No one else was drinking it. Not no one, but there was only a smaller handful of restaurants in Florida, never mind Tampa, who were actually buying and collecting and putting these wines on a wine list. It wasn't the thing to do in the 70s.
So when you have a huge wine list like this, you're kind of the go-to guy for someone who is looking at that list for the first time and doesn't really know where to start. What kind of advice do you give people that are trying to navigate a giant wine list? Where do they start? Should they ask for help?
Yes. You know, and people often ask me, what do I drink? What do I like? Well, I tell them, it doesn't really matter what I like, because if you're not happy, then, I mean, number one, the customer has to be happy. So I always start, you know, what do you guys like? What do you want to drink? You know, what fruit profile? You know, there's about 10 questions when asking somebody that you can kind of discern what it is they're kind of looking for. Now, to me, the most fun part is feel like we love everything. We want to try something really cool. We've never had wine with age. So those are, you know, oftentimes the fun tables. But, you know, the hard side of that is, you know, the older a wine gets, the softer it gets. All that bright fruit kind of turns into more dried fruit, more tertiary characteristics. So it's, you also have to be able to explain that to your customer, knowing that that's what they're going to expect. But people love it. I mean, people try it. You know, it's a birth year wine or this, that. You know, it's the anniversary wine, wine their parents were born. It's a pretty cool. It's pretty cool that you get to be part of, you know, these people's celebrations. It's fun.
Yeah, but do you have pushback sometimes from people that are used to maybe like a fruit bomb Zinfandel, and they come in and they have an aged wine and they don't really know how to appreciate it?
You know, it's more rare than people would think, because, you know, it's one of the things the staff, you know, it's myself and two other somms right now. And something we really try to show the customer, explain to the customer what they're going to expect. Because if they really love, like you said, a big, juicy Sonoma Zin, they're not going to like an older one. If they want really big, heavy tannin, high alcohol, you know, make your teeth purple wine, they're not going to like an old Bordeaux. So it's again, helping them to navigate the list and what it is that's going to make them happy.
Yeah, it's kind of fun. You see people that know that they're supposed to like it and appreciate it, and whether they actually do to their taste or not is to be determined, you know?
Right. Again, that's one of the things I'm really proud of on our glass list. We have, you know, 150 wines. We've got everything from actually Camus, Silver Oak, and Chateau Montelena by the glass to Rombauer Shard to the Belglas Pinot. That being said, we have 5 different white Burgundies by the glass, 4 or 5 different Bordeaux by the glass. Going back to a 1996 Bordeaux that we use a Corrigan on. We've got 3 red Burgundies by the glass, including a Premier Cru red Burgundy by the glass. So we can almost make anybody happy, and we can also give people a taste of something. So if they think they might like something, we can kind of give them, you know, an ounce and see if it's something they would like or maybe not. So, you know, we have some fallbacks and some things that are on our side that we're able to, you know, really try to make most of our guests happy.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with me today about the award, and congratulations once again for keeping it going, even though the industry continues to evolve and change and make it more difficult.
Well, thank you very much.
While Burns is in Tampa, Blue Provence is right here in Naples, and it's a family-owned gem near Creighton Cove in the old part of town. The Cario family has made it a truly family-run affair, with Jacques and Liziel running the front of the house and back of the house, respectively. Their sons, Clement and Kevin, help manage things along with a staff that has a loyalty seldom found in the restaurant industry. Jacques and Clement are here in the studio with me now to talk about the grand award the restaurant has received a number of times in a row. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us, Julie. Bonjour.
Thank you for having us.
We are talking about award-winning wine lists with the creators of one of the world's best, as deemed by the Wine Spectator magazine. Do you have a question for our experts? Give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. You can also visit WGCUnews.org for more ways to get in touch. First, congratulations to you both. Jacques, tell me
Thank
what
you.
It means to have the restaurant be awarded such an honor.
Well, it was totally unexpected because we built those wine lists by passion and by listening to the people who make the wine and sharing emotion like you can share a book, you know, when you really meet a fantastic book, you want to give it to the whole world to read. And it was the motivation behind building that wine list. So when they came to our door and say, you know, we came to check out if it's real, it was totally unexpected, and it was a great joy and great honor.
So it wasn't a award that you sought out?
No.
It just kind of came to your door?
It came naturally.
And this was 3 years ago?
It was 3 years ago. I was thinking that I would never get an honor like that because we are not into depths, you know, a lot, first growth Bordeaux, all the classic stuff that makes the classical wine list very special. We are more into 70 wine from Corsica, you know, 100 wine from Languedoc, from part of Italy that nobody knows about. And it's our passion is more under the kind of underground, kind of terroir-oriented little gem and not the classic. So it was very surprising.
So it's unusual places instead of all of the greatest hits that everybody tries to get their hands
absolutely.
On.
Absolutely.
So, Clement, you're pretty active in the wine industry nationally. How do people react when they hear about this award at your family's restaurant?
Well, it certainly isn't a bad thing. Usually when I talk to wine people when I'm out, it's people from major markets like New York and San Francisco, and they have a hard time placing Naples on the map usually. But as soon as I tell them that we received the Grand Award, they tend to accept me much more easily then. The reaction is always very positive, and there's not any more people will think that we're from a small market and we're not important at that point.
Yeah, I mean, there isn't even one in Miami.
No, there isn't. Actually, there's only four now in Florida, and we were the first one since 1981 to receive an award after Burn Steakhouse, along with Marcello Las Sirenas. And the other one in 81 was the Breakers HMF.
But for this year, there's just the two.
For this year.
2017, yes. There's just the two. So, Jacques, tell me a little bit about Blue Provence, the backstory. I don't know this, and I've been there a few times. So when did you open, and what brought you to Naples?
So we opened in 1999. We came to Naples by accident. We were cruising around Florida, and we fall in love like many, many, many other people, 90% of the population here, which is not local, native.
So you happened to stop off in Naples, and
yes.
You're like...
And we came back on vacation for 8 years in a row, and we moved, and then we got bored staying on the beach on the boat, and we opened the restaurant. It was in late 99.
In late 1999,
yes.
You got bored and decided to open a restaurant.
We got bored at home, so we decided to open it, and we're not bored anymore.
No, it's a workaholic all the time.
Yes.
And that's
mostly my mother who was bored.
Mostly, well, she's quite the chef. So, so Clement, you and your brother are both there. Did it kind of seem like a natural fit for you to just get involved with the restaurant, or did you want to do something else? Did you want to be a firefighter?
Well, actually, when I was a very little kid, my dream was to be a lawyer. I know. But then thankfully, after moving to the U.S. and starting working with my parents, you know, I kind of went through all the staff position at the restaurant, and my father kept making me taste wines. They were fabulous. And eventually I thought, I should be looking into this more. And people were telling me I was a pretty good taster, so it encouraged me to go further into it, and I'm certainly not regretting it.
Well, studying law and doing that kind of research and knowing the backstory and the history, and law has an impact on wine too, as far as the designation of different crus in France, for example. It kind of goes hand in hand with wanting to study wine, although wine's a little bit more fun.
Yes, definitely. I think you can enjoy the work a little more, especially because it's more refreshing, I think.
Yeah, it's great to have the story behind it, too. And some of the politics behind wine, too. There's a lot to study there.
And that's just one facet of what we study. You also have geology, history, and with the laws, weather, grip varietals, even the growing, the type of trying system they're using. So it goes in depth for sure. It's never ending. You can get to chemistry. You can it's how far you want to push it. You can get there.
You have to be a master of all trades to make a decent wine. And I wanted to ask Jacques also. You opened in 99. When did wine become such a huge part of it? I mean, there's obviously food and wine pairs together naturally, but there was an expansion of the wine list, the addition of the retail space. What brought all that on?
Yep. It was trying to find an excuse to my wife to get more wine on the wine list, and to explain my obsession and trying to find always more. And always it's also what was killing me is each time we were losing a wine on the wine list was not available anymore. It was like I was losing a family member. So I try to have more to protect myself to be, because it's every wine we have is something I need in my life. I need to be around them. So
you have an emotional connection to each wine on your list.
Yes, because it's extremely it's a product of it's a stubbornness of civilization wine. It's come from the capricious nature of Vitis vinifera, which is the only vine available at the beginning that became all those different adjust to and mutate to every different place in our world and became all these different grapes that we know now. And so the capricious nature of Vitis vinifera plus the stubbornness of people, of human beings that wrote this history of every vineyard for centuries.
Kind of taming that vine.
Yes.
The kind of the human mastery over a wild vine like that is pretty interesting. Is there a certain wine region right now that has your attention?
Yes, as many. First of all, I need to mention California because there's a new generation of Californians that are starting to get to the freshness, the purity, the natural way of making wine. And I just had a 10-year-old Diatom lately. It was remarkable, remarkable. So there's really something moving there with new people. Of course, there's Corsica, there's Languedoc, which is our California in France, where everything happens, new stuff happens all the time, where people finding old, reviving old terroir. And you have this incredible depths of Italy. They have, I don't know how many, hundreds of local grapes that are obscure or not been really valorized now, and it's coming really big. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. So these things sound like just completely foreign to a lot of people who don't know anything about wine. So when you have this, when you're talking about all these wines, there are a lot of people that don't know anything about any of them, and all they really know is their Santa Margherita Pinot Grigio or their Meiomi Pinot Noir or their Sonoma Couture Chardonnay. How do you get somebody into a wine list as complex?
Well, I'm going to explain my strategy, and then I'm going to let Clément explain hers. I go to a table and I try to profile them. I ask them what they like, what they drink at home, if they remember the brand on the label. And I want to bring them something that is in my world, but not too far away from their comfort zone in terms of taste.
Yeah, you don't want to take them too far out because they won't like it.
No, not too far out. Yeah. And also they know that they can't always send the bottle back. We're going to drink the wine they send back happily with the staff later. So they know they have no problem, no risk, no money, no monetary risk, no dollar risk.
Yeah, and since they're all members of your family, every one of those wines, you're going to enjoy it anyway,
yes,
even if somebody
absolutely
decides they don't like it. We have a call coming in from Molly in Estero. Molly, what would you like to ask?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have been drinking pretty much red wine all my life. And when I lived in Michigan, we had basements to keep it nice and cool year-round. Down in Florida here, we have no basements. I do have a wine refrigerator, and that helps. But when I go to a restaurant and I'm paying anywhere from $10 to $15 for 6 ounces of red wine, and it's at 78 degrees, I'm pretty disgusted. What are you doing in your restaurant to combat this, or do you do anything about chilling the red wines?
That is a great question for Clément.
Yes, so we usually keep our wines overnight in the fridge. So when we do open them for our guests, they're coming out and they're around, they'll warm up a little bit. We'll take them out around 4. By the time it's 5, they're about 60, 65 degrees. So that's what we'll do for our red wines. But then I've cooled down red wines. I've warmed up red wines. You know, if you tell us you want your wine one way or another, we'll serve it to you that way. We'll make it happen. We can change temperatures of wine gently in a few minutes. It's fairly easy for us to do.
It's pretty easy to bring it to the correct temperature. Now, tell me about the cellar. The cellar is, I mean, even the store is cold. I mean, you walk in and it's not just air conditioned.
58 degrees.
Yeah. It's very refreshing when it's hot outside.
80% humidity. Mm.
So how many square feet do you have under that kind of temperature?
About 2,000 square feet.
Under
58 degrees and
80% air conditioning.
Humidity. Yeah.
And then the flooring, what I found intriguing, is four layers of cork?
Yes, we have 3 inches of cork on the floor, so we save thousands of bottles because they slip and they fall.
They roll off the shelf,
they fell on the floor, or sometimes we let them go. And the cork also keep away a lot of bugs. So it's an insulation, it's a safeguard for breaking, and it's pretty comfortable to walk and work and walk there and work there, and it has many advantages.
And it keeps bugs away.
Yes.
And it smells good.
Yeah, it does. So I wanted to ask also, so when you're sitting down and you're looking at this big, huge wine list, everybody wants to get their wine going pretty quick. Do you decide on your wine and then choose what kind of food to follow, or do you choose your food and then decide what kind of wine to order with it?
Well, that depends how hung up you are on your wine pairing. If you really want something that's going to match your food perfectly, then pick your food first and then pick the wine. What I recommend for my guests to do is tell me what you like. I'll pick you a great wine that's just like that. And the food, you know, it's going to be okay. It's not that big of a deal in the end. You will still enjoy your meal. And you'll probably enjoy it better if you have a wine that you truly like than something that I picked for you that goes with your food, but that's not up to your standards or just not your profile.
Yeah, it's not really your scene.
Right.
Like, so if I were to get a ribeye, and what would I get? What kind of wine would I get?
Well, a good pairing to go with that would be a Barolo or a red Bordeaux. We can even do something from Northern Rhone. You know, any one of those wines will do, or even a Napa Cab, of course.
But is it tragic if somebody really likes white wine and they order a ribeye and they want to have a white wine with it?
I don't think so.
What?
Not tragic.
That's not tragic?
No, as long as they're happy and they enjoyed it.
As long as they're happy. So those hard and fast rules about red wine with red meat and white wine with white meat, no longer, they can be a good guide, but definitely not a hard and fast rule.
It's better if you do that at your house. You know, you can control the environment and you let all your guests know that's what's going to happen. But we're in the business of making people happy, and whatever they want is what they're going to get.
That's great. It kind of takes some of the intimidation factor away for some people.
Oh, yes.
Do you find – what have been some of the reactions? Have you had a reaction from anybody that was just overjoyed with a pairing that you exposed them to a new wine and they just
– All the time.
What do they say?
I'm just kidding a little bit. But people discover a new flavor, a new stuff. They are just amazed. It's like, as I mentioned at the beginning, the reading of a new book. You know, it's something – it's emotional. It's it changed something, a little something in your life. It's really magical what happened when you find a new wine that you like.
I mean, it's pretty awesome to see the expression on their faces when they're discovering something totally new that they didn't know they like. It's always makes us happy.
It's got to be a good feeling when you just see somebody being that satisfied.
You never know. Some people might be hiding what they really think. So I know if I did a good job, people really, really were happy, especially when I get a tip. That's what I know.
Yeah, all right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but I want to thank our guests, Eric Renault from Burns Steakhouse in Tampa, and also thanks to Jacques and Clément Carriel from Blue Provence in Naples. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you very much.
And congratulations once again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our show today was produced by Matthew Smith. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.